Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
That wasn't me.
No, it wasn't.
That was our guest.
Yes, it was. We're so excited to have back with us again Manola Dargis, the New York Times.
Hello, I'm so delighted to be here.
Oh, good. So,
last week, you shined us on. And you...
I was stuck at your an diva, airport.
We didn't fulfill all of your diva demands.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, we didn't have enough tube rose candles.
You refused to enter the apartment.
I
but
said,
after we fulfilled the rider details in your contract,
all those brown M&Ms
everything's
gone.
Fine now, and we're happy to have you here.
Well, the Oakland airport was so appealing. I just couldn't leave for hours on end. Yes, so I'm really happy to be here, and I'm really sorry that I missed the show last week. No. The show is fabulous.
This, if you're listening for the very first time, my name's Dave White.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
We are the hosts, and we generally we have Manol on every year at this time.
Yes.
Yeah. This has become a tradition now.
Yes.
I know, it's lovely.
And but now I'm excited because you expressed interest in coming on more often, and I would love to have you here more often. So I'm...
the door is open.
Yeah. You need to be a regular.
Oh, I would love that. That would be great. I mean, it would be super nice.
And off to the side, again, once again,
yes,
just like last week, is our friend Matt.
Yes.
Who Hi, just man. Wanted to come and hang out.
That's right. Next level film art
and
film bro.
Again, Matt. I may have you come hang out every week because this is now 2 weeks in a row.
And he's brought good treats.
He's brought really good treats, saving me from having to make anything.
Yes.
Even though there's a cake, a really ugly cake.
That's what frosting is for.
Cooling on the rack behind you. Well, the layer that went on the bottom rack got a little browner than the other one, and I've had to slice it around. I just had to cut all that stuff off. Look, it's for Pilar.
Yes.
She's going to be happy that it exists, so that's our niece. It's her birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Pilar.
I made the Funfetti cake from the Momofuku Milk Bar.
From Fun Scratch.
From scratch, that's right. Well, pretty that's cool. The only way, that's the best way to make a cake.
I would say it's not the only way. You just buy the Funfetti stuff. You made the Funfetti
box stuff. Cakes actually are the best. They're better than your homemade cake almost all the time.
Yeah, that's what food expert Margie Rockman tells us this all the time.
Okay. But... I just felt like trying to make the Funfetti from scratch.
Dang.
So I think it looks awfully pretty.
So. Well, it's pretty because of the Funfetti. But you shouldn't be able to see the Funfetti because there should not be a burned part cut off.
Oh,
if
I
you
see.
Understand what I'm saying?
It's too constructed.
There you go.
Pretty much. Yeah. Well, anyway, so Matt brought macaron last week and these like chocolate croissants this week. Oh, and
I just had a bit of soft something that was just amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know what, I don't even know what you call it, but it was like half chocolate, half
so
not.
So basically, you just be our pastry guy from now on.
Pastry pimp.
No,
pastry pimp.
No pressure. So I wanted to start this with, of the long list of things that you don't get to do because of the New York Times, like you're no longer an LA Film Critics, which sucks because we had our dinner last night. And you got name checked, by the way. By Raoul Peck.
Cool.
He thanked you and several other people not in our group and Kenny Turan for your all years of support. But anyway, so did you do the Village Voice year-end poll, or is that also?
I didn't, but it wasn't an intentional slight. And just by the way, I just want to plug Raoul Peck's movie, which is I Am Not Your Negro.
Yes, so
which
good.
Is a fantastic movie. It was on my top 10 last year because it opened for 1 week. For Academy
Awards.
Consideration.
When does
and
it open?
February.
February.
It opens soon.
Right.
We will be talking about it. It's so great.
It is really, truly a fantastic movie, and everybody should go see it. It should be top of your list.
It won the Doc Award from LAFCA in a very competitive year.
Yeah. Really, I mean, it's such a great year for Docs, and we can talk about that
totally.
A little later.
Yeah,
but I really completely forgot what you were asking.
I was asking if you'd done the Village Voice poll.
I didn't.
Only because they ask a question that I love, which is movie everyone else is wrong about. Which can be a movie that everybody loves that you didn't care for, or a movie that you hated that everybody... Anyway, you know what I mean.
A movie you loved that everyone hated.
Yeah, or vice versa. Yeah.
I don't think there was anything that extreme this year. You know, I don't feel like... I think everyone basically that I know didn't like Collateral Beauty, or actually really hated Collateral Beauty. I think we're all on a page there.
Hang on just a moment.
Let's put a pin in that one.
Here comes the first digression of probably many. We've discussed this a little bit already, but... There hasn't been in recent times a moment when I've been more proud to know you than your reaction to Collateral Beauty.
In the moment.
In public, in the moment, at the Arclight, banging on the walls of the theater, like with both fists, F this movie, and then yelling at the security guy as we were walking out, and you were like, it sucks! And he's like, oh. Like,
no,
people were clearing a path for you.
It was when you said, I hated it, the New York Times. Put your hand up like that was going to be the blurb for the poster.
Oh, yeah, I kind of forgot about that. It was like the movie that broke me. And I was having a fun time because I was walking out with you and we were all kind of feeling the hate at the same time. But, you know, so there's this, I feel uncomfortable doing this, but I am going to name drop. Years ago, I interviewed Paul Schrader, who, of course, is very famous for having written Taxi Driver. And he had a movie that he had directed, really, really good movie called Afflicted. Yeah. And he told a little story about going to see Warren Beatty's... Is it Reds? I always screw this up.
We'll fix that.
Okay.
Don't worry.
So it's Reds. And he was... At the time, Schrader was working on a movie, and he said, oh, I can't, Warren, I can't. I'm working on my movie. And Warren's like, no, you have to come, you have to come. He basically browbeat him. And finally, Schrader does. He goes to the screening, and he falls asleep. and he sleeps through the whole movie, I think. And I may be embellishing a little, but he sleeps through the movie. And apparently, according to Schrader, Beatty had some spies, as people do, in the screening room. And so they dutifully reported back to Beatty that Schrader had fallen asleep in the movie.
Oh, my.
So, of course, what happens is that Warren Beatty calls Paul Schrader and yells at him, how could you do this? I spent 10 years of my life on this movie. How could you fall asleep? And Schrader says, but Paul, I'm assuming, and I'm sorry, I'm Warren. Sorry for that. Warren, you know, 10 years of your life is not as important to me as 3 hours of mine. Now, the thing is, like, I met Schrader years later, and he did not remember me, of course, and he told that same story. So, again, but I actually think it's, you know, it's important because you have to, it's one of the kind of, I know people think that movie critics are really cold-hearted, and some of us can be sometimes, but it's like, I always want the movie to be great. And part of it's because the pleasure of movies. I love movies so much, and I want everything to be so wonderful, and it's disappointing.
We walk into everything with that hope.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. And if you ever walk into a movie without that hope, you should definitely hang it up. But also, then it becomes a question of, like, my life and the time that it took me to get to set up, you know, to, like, find the screening, arrange to go see the screening,
drive there,
get to the screening, park, et cetera, then sit through it. And it may seem really trivial, but frankly, yes, 2, 3, 4, or 5 hours of my life are more important. And then also, if you're reviewing it, then you have to live with that sucker, you know, yes. And that's just really dispiriting because you have to, like, get it up basically for this terrible movie that has sucked time and, you know, and it's like, I don't have time, but, you know, this is one of the things. So I felt like collateral damage, felt so cynical. And it's also because I really like some of the actors in it. And I just thought, like, how does this happen? You know, so that was really it was comic, but it was also, I was actually angry. I mean, I was truly angry.
We were all feeling it.
Can I ask you guys a question? Like,
sure.
Are you worried about Will Smith at all?
No. He's made some odd choices of late, I will say. I mean, this and After Earth and you know, I mean, it was a cameo.
What's the one where the jellyfish kills him in the tub?
Oh, 7 pounds,
yes.
That
was great.
I you know, I mean, obviously he was wise to not do Independence Day Resurgence, so I think mm-hmm. we should give him credit for that.
Yes.
But he does lately seem to be in kind of a... Is he Oscar chasing? What? I don't know what he's doing.
I'm not sure, but I was wondering because I was thinking about him, and you know, I'm a big Tom Cruise fan, and I want no like jeering, please. But I think right. I'm thinking about these later middle-aged guys and the kind of difficulty of making the transition, like that. I feel like Cruise, I think, really is wrong to try to do these Jack Reacher movies. I don't think they work for him, mm-hmm. and I'm just thinking like they seem a little lost. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of that thing where, you know, I can't, for Will Smith, it's like, well, I can't be the Bad Boys guy forever. Although there is going to be a Bad Boys 3, right?
Oh,
that's or 4 or whatever. It's
something
however
like
many
that.
There have been.
But yeah, but then it's sort of like, but if I'm not that, what am I? Mm-hmm. You know, and so maybe he's just trying to figure out what his, how does he segue from being like young and brash and the smile and the, you know, the ha-cha-cha to being, you know, the new Sidney Poitier or whatever.
I think that. One of the trends that we're seeing is a lack of movie stars that you can count on mm-hmm. to make big movies that make lots of money.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And so people who got their start young as big stars and who played that lane of acting. Of film stardom. I'm in the new giant space alien movie. I'm in the new Nazi killing movie. I'm in the whatever, mm-hmm. whatever the big movie is. It stars Will Smith. It stars Tom Cruise. It stars whoever. And for every person that they tried to make the next big thing and it didn't stick, and that person immediately found, or after a little bit of time, found their way some other way, Colin Farrell.
I was just going to say Colin Farrell.
Remember how early on they were like, he's going to be in SWAT, and it's going to be huge,
and then it
stunk, and he didn't become Tom Cruise. Instead, we learned that he's good at acting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And in smaller films that were unusual that not as many people saw.
Yeah, and despite being crazy handsome, like he's a character actor right. with the face of a movie star.
Well, so is Brad Pitt in a way. I mean, right. I mean, yeah. even though, yeah. You know, I think he can still, I mean, the zombie movie I think did quite well. He can yeah. still be, I mean, I don't know if he opened that movie or if the zombies opened that movie. I'm not
right.
really sure, but
right.
you know, I do think this is kind of, I'm not sure if I'd call it a crisis in stardom, but it's really interesting when you look at like the history of stardom and how it's really changed. And it has really changed during the lifetimes of both Will Smith and Tom Cruise.
Right. Mm. So they're trying to find
yeah.
their way
yeah.
somehow,
yeah.
some other way.
Yeah. No, it's really, really interesting because it just feels like the kind of durability of stardom is no longer guaranteed,
yeah.
you know, at all.
Sure.
So
isn't Julia Roberts doing a TV show now?
Yeah, when she...
Well, good for her,
and
though.
Sure, absolutely.
And, well, she should. I'm
so
just
is
saying,
Tom Hardy.
But that's... I'm just saying, that's... You know, as you talk about the changing nature of it, there was a time when that would be like, oh, well, she's thrown in the towel.
Right, right.
But now, obviously, given the changing nature of the TV is sort of where the action is, that it actually reads differently.
Or
you know?
People keep telling us that's where the action is.
Well, it's... I mean, there's a lot of... As we've said before,
yes,
I mean, we've
we
talked
have.
About this, there's a ton of crap on television.
Yes.
There always will be. But the best TV is... better than a lot of the second best movies.
And it's on the Learning Channel.
No, so
that's just me.
So yeah, no, I was I just like that, you know, everyone else is wrong question because like I think their top vote getter this year actually was La La Land, which, you know,
I'm not like either for or there's no like in terms of the movies that people have embraced like Manchester by the Sea. I like it. I think it's okay. I don't think it's great, you know, but it was already, the word masterpiece was being shouted in my ear when I saw it at Sundance
right.
last year. And
that was that was actually my vote for this category.
But it's just like, I don't, you know, I don't have, I like it. I don't think Kenneth Lonergan is a terribly interesting director. Sorry, I just don't. I'm a movie director. And La La Land, I think, is, I like its ambition. I like things about it very much. I love the last 20 minutes. I wish that the rest of the movie were the last 20 minutes. I'm not going to say what the last 20 minutes are, but when you see the movie, you'll understand.
Yep. So. We just read a letter from a listener who's 17, and she and her best friend went to see La La Land, and
were devastated.
Devastated, sobbing, hysterical, shrieking, crying during the last 15 minutes, and had to be comforted by all, like, the old people
who were in the theater. That is awesome. That is screening with them.
And I just thought that was so sweet and cool that that happened.
I think that's beautiful. And yeah. I am such a big musical fan that my greatest... The thing I like most about La La Land, in a way, is just it's the genre, you know,
yeah,
that it exists, that someone is actually making a complete flat out musical, you know, and I think that's just beautiful. And he's got such great intelligence about musicals. You know, I was on the set when they were shooting that, and for 2 days, I don't visit a lot of sets, but I was on that set, and I saw them shooting a couple of the dance sequences, and the whole time Damien Chazelle, when they were shooting, with this amazing, I wrote about this for a piece, but using this amazing crane that was incredible, really kind of with the camera at the end of this huge crane, and the crane operator was physically moving around, and Damien Chazelle kept saying, head toe, head toe, head toe, head toe. And that, I realized, like, this is a serious musical person, because he was letting you know that he wanted to get the performers, and Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, from head to toe, which is a real old, really a Fred Astaire thing.
And totally.
And that was really great. So I realized that even though he's in his early 30s, Damien Chazelle was an old-fashioned, you know, musical lover. Mm. And that was really great to see that.
It was funny because I just was rewatching Umbrellas of Cherbourg with a friend who'd never seen it.
Love.
And I had forgotten that two of the main characters in that movie are named Guy and Madeline, and his first film is Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. Like, I did not had not added all that together before. Now, are you Team Moonlight on this? I mean, are you a fan?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of Moonlight. It was on my top 10. I think it's great. I mean, that was one of those movies where I'd heard a little too much about. Like, I saw that last fall, like, early for the New York Film Festival, and I'd already heard it was great, and it was one of those things where I just want to cover my ears, go, la, 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 la. I don't want to hear it. I love, it's just like, please, everyone, shut up. I don't want to hear how great you're, you know, stop talking to me about this. And I went in and, you know, you really try to leave skepticism at the door. You know, we talked about just walking in and being really open. And so I was like, oh, and I really, really liked his other movie. But I was just, it was so great to be watching and thinking, oh, this is a great movie. This is unequivocally a great movie. This is unmistakably, and just, you know, feeling so taken by it and just feeling so thrilled. I don't know, for myself, that I feel privileged to be able to, like, be here and watch this happening now, and it's exciting. It's really exciting. I love it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where you can't wait to tell people about it and to sort of just, like, proselytize on its behalf. It was my number one movie of the year, but I have, like, there's the one tiny thing about it, and I almost asked the director about it last night when I met him at the Lafka dinner. Only there's one song choice toward the end of the film.
Oh.
That is, for me, in already indelibly linked to two other movies.
Wait, have you and I talked about this?
I don't know if we have.
Mm.
I don't think this isn't really a spoiler, but toward the end of the film, the soundtrack contains Caetano Veloso's Cuckoo Cuckoo Paloma.
Oh, that's right.
Which I had originally knew as, oh, yeah, and Talk to Her, there's that amazing sequence where he performs it. And then I went back later and discovered that Almodovar had already stolen it from Wong Kar-wai.
From Wong Kar-wai.
Who does it in Happy Together. And so when it came up in Moonlight, I'm like, oh, really? Okay. Like, I just thought, like, this song is taken, you know. So I thought it didn't ruin anything for me. I was just kind of shocked that he went there with that one.
But Moonlight is so, I mean, it's such a, you know, clearly Barry Jenkins, the director, truly loves Wong Kar-wai. You know, Wong Kar-wai is probably the most obvious influence in some ways on that movie, in terms of creating expressions and deep emotions, not necessarily through the dialogue and through color and through, you know, and just this kind of, and what the stuff that is left unsaid, which of course Wong Kar-wai is just wonderful at. And, you know, people who are not necessarily, haven't been in therapy and can't necessarily talk about their actualization. So how do you actually express the deepness of their emotions, the profundity of their emotions? I think, you know, songs, Wong Kar-wai, that seemed like a real reference to Happy Together.
No, certainly. And on that level, it totally works. Yeah. But it just, at the same time, it's just like, I just think there are certain songs where, like, they're taken, you know? you don't get to go back to that well because they belong in a certain place.
Which is why, just when we were just talking about that date scene in Christine,
mm-hmm.
with a really unusual musical choice.
Right.
No one goes back in time. No filmmaker goes back and says, you know what? We need a song by the Guess Who in this sequence. You know, like, and that they did, and that it worked so, so heartbreakingly well,
mm-hmm.
in that moment. And again, the same kind of character who's so stuck and trapped in the thing that she's in, she can't tell you what it is. And the song makes it happen.
That movie hasn't gotten very much love, or not enough love, I don't think.
I just watched it for the first time 4 days ago.
Okay.
And I didn't see it in its release, and then we got the screener, and it was on the top of the stack, and I finally picked it up, and we just talked about it on the last episode. Mm-hmm. And I was so overwhelmed by it, and its sadness, that we didn't even record the day that we were going to, because I was like, I can't be peppy for you right now. I have to go make dinner and think about this movie. Yeah.
That's a movie where I feel like, and we don't have to talk about it since you just did, but I have to say one thing. I just think where really the actress makes it for me.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean,
yes.
The way I feel like Isabelle Huppert makes Elle for me. You know, I just feel
right.
You know, this is such a, this actress is doing something so remarkable that whatever qualms I have about the movie just fade away with every moment of that great performance, you know?
Yeah.
You know, speaking of just kind of, you know, we were talking about women filmmakers.
And I'm a woman.
Yes. What a coincidence. One of the things that drove me batty this year was how badly Disney sold Queen of Katwe.
Disney is very good at selling product, you know, and if you have things that don't fit into a certain kind of Disney product, I mean, that's one of the problems, you know, in terms of a company that is so product driven, is that if you actually have something that does not conform to product, it becomes really difficult. I mean, you used to see this with some of the other studios when they had different boutiques, you know, different divisions and the smaller divisions.
The little indie.
Right. Yeah. So like, you know, and certainly a company like Warner Independent Pictures, which our friend Laura Kim was part of running, they knew how to sell the movies. But there were other big studios that really had a very difficult time because it was like they were used to putting out a big movie that was going to make billions of dollars.
And open on 2,500 screens.
Exactly. And then like, and now they had this smaller thing that they just, I sometimes felt like they would look at it quizzically and think, what is this thing? You know? And I feel with Disney, you know, you look at Disney, Disney's very good at its branded product, and it's a small world after all that takes up the entire universe. So but having something that does not fit within that kind of paradigm, I think can be very difficult, and it's not even a fault of the marketing department necessarily. It's just like they don't do that, you know. There's no like Miramax division there to sell that movie for the big company.
It's like that old Altman line about like Hollywood makes hats and I make shoes, you know, that it's just not the thing that they know how to do. But even as like, I mean, it was an ESPN co-production. It was a sports movie, you know, and they sort of have their annual sports movie now, whether it's the, you know, John Hamm Goes to India or whatever. And even on that level, I felt like they didn't know how to sell this thing. Like the posters all looked like broccoli. They all look like, oh, it's a movie about Africa, everybody. You know, that's not going to be any fun. And it's so, like, uplifting and old-fashionedly rousing, you know, that film. I think you really could have connected with an audience if they just figured out how to do that.
But you need...
And full of crying. They should have sold the crying. Seriously. Because everybody likes to go cry in the movies.
But, I mean, think about what Disney... I mean, Disney has, you know, Disney has Disney movies, but it also has
Star Wars and
Pixar,
Avengers.
And it now has Lucasfilms and has Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I think for a company that is so obviously directed to... I mean, you know, they had more than 25% of the domestic box office was Disney last year.
Yeah.
That is mind-blowing. You know, and so what they do very, 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 very well. Whether we like it or not is another thing. But when you have a movie that does not fit into that little, you know, that it's a square that does not fit into that circle peg, I think it's just really difficult. And it's just what I would really like to see a return to these separate divisions, because I think that the studios occasionally do have these movies and they just seem completely confused and bewildered by them, and they just kind of die.
I remember before there was Warner Independent, Warner Brothers would every so often find themselves with a movie like the Claude Lelouch Les Miserables or something, where you could tell they just had no idea. No idea. They would dump it in a few like major cities and try and sort of get some art house traction and then just like back away slowly.
They don't even know how to do the posters, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's just like, and again, I'm not blaming those people. It's like they do what they do very, very, very well, you know? But it's asking them to do anything else. And so right now, you know, there's not, these divisions for the most part don't exist. There's just a couple of them. And so it's really kind of disappointing because it just feels like nothing but big, big, big movies and a lot of little cheap, fat little movies. So,
What were some movies last year that you kind of tried to champion and felt like the people just weren't hearing about them or seeing them or, you know?
Oh, I don't know. So many. I mean, do I think people pay attention to movie critics? I think that they pay attention to them when it's convenient to pay attention to them. I think they pay attention for non-big movies, you know? I think they're, and I don't mean even just little movies. I think anything that's not really kind of the franchise stuff, maybe
they were
going to
see anyway. Yeah.
So I mean, there's nothing in particular that really, and it's already January, and I've completely forgotten most of 2016 anyway. So.
I think in general, most folks don't pay any attention to us, and then the people who do, I think, for the most part, they go about it the right way. They pick the ones whose writing they like, or whose video they like, or whatever way you're getting your message out,
or podcast they like,
or podcast, yeah. And then you sort of engage with that person, even if it's not a two-way street, and so you then, as you're just a regular, you know, person doing your job, you've got your little list, and you eventually you get to the thing that the film critic you like said you should find somehow. That's what I did when I was a middle school teacher in Fort Worth, Texas. I was reading film critics and trying to figure out how I was going to get to see that movie, even though I lived in Fort Worth, Texas. Wow. And you know, that was, and I think people do. I know that the response that I've always gotten from, even when I wasn't even really writing film reviews and I was just writing little blurby things to goof on stuff for iFilm in the very beginning of my time at movies.com, people came to me and they stuck around and they contacted me and they were like, I don't think you write about this or that. But how do I find this other one that you keep going on and on about?
Well, it's interesting because, like, you know, you've always been, for the last year, have been banging the drum for Cemetery Splendor, and I have for Take Me to the River.
Yes.
And I think we more often get response from, say, people that listen to this show who
absolutely
will tweet us and say, oh, hey,
absolutely,
I watched it, and you're right, or you're dumb, or whatever.
No.
But, like, other like, L.A. sort of film types that we know, they just kind of glaze over.
Starting in 2010-ish, when Movies.com said, hey, we're going to have you write proper reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for the next 5 years of working for them, I wrote,
non-bullet points.
Proper film reviews. And I would get feedback from that work sometimes. But the podcast has resulted in, people coming back to us and saying, you told me about this just obscure little thing, and now I've seen it.
Yeah, how many of our listeners saw the Touring Horse because of you?
I know how many, because they contact me on Twitter.
Yes.
And they say, I finally watched the Touring Horse because of Linoleum Knife. And that just makes me really happy that happened.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
And I didn't, I wrote a review for it at movies.com, but it was crickets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the movies.com's fault, honestly, because it was a low prestige site and they didn't bother pushing anything anywhere any of the time, which is why I quit. And
there's a joke about Fandango, by the way, on the new Saturday Night Live.
Good, there should be. And so, but having this format where we're talking to people is, it reaches as many, if not more people than writing.
Yeah.
And
it's intimate. I mean, I think having the voices in your ear, there's a kind of real intimacy to it. It's really conversational. It's really nice. I mean, it's interesting because we were just talking about social media. I'm now on Twitter and I now have a Facebook account. And I like engaging with people. I don't like being yelled at, and I sure don't like hate mail. And I get some really terrible hate mail at the New York Times. Like, really, really horrible hate mail. Like, you know, words cannot be said. Right. And things that you think, really, you had nothing better to do than, like, you know, like, I mean, just kind of people who
and
are
the
just,
answer is no, they didn't. Yeah,
I guess they didn't.
And you're going to choose this hill to die on?
And I, you know, and I believe in the power of movies, and I believe in movies, but there's also part of me that says, this is a movie, and we're disagreeing about it, and you want me dead? Like, seriously? Yeah. Like, this seems absurd to me, and it's, you know, and I've always tried to write, when people write to me, you know, in my inbox in the New York Times, I try to write back to them unless it's a cascade of hate. And then I'm like, walk away from the inbox. but I do like, I like turning people onto movies. That's something really, that's really a delicious part of the job. You know, that's really, really, you know, if people are going to go see I Am Not Your Negro, the Raoul Peck movie, because I wrote something about it, then I feel happy about that. That makes me feel really good. At the same time, you know, I think there's some of our colleagues have a much more kind of like a missionary aspect to their criticism, you know, and I feel like, and I, in the sense that sometimes I feel it's not always good because propping up kind of bad small movies because they were made by a small filmmaker and we feel sad and we don't want to be mean and you know, I don't think that's good. And then, you know, but it's finding the place of advocacy where you're then also not being patronizing, you know. And in the end, for me, it's about the movies, but it's also about I want to be honest with the reader, with my readers, and say, you know, honestly, this is not something you should see or you should see. And also, you know, there's a little Consumer Reports thing. I think for some critics, particularly who don't think of themselves, who are, there's some people who don't like the consumer advocate part of the job, but actually, or Consumer Reports part, I feel like people need to know if I like a movie or not. I feel like that's something like I need to let them know. I'm not writing for, you know, Cahiers du Cinéma, and but I also am trying to write the smartest, best work I can. But I also need to let them know. You know, I need to let them know if it works or not. But I think you go to critics because of trust and because of, but then you go to other critics not because of their taste or you agree with them. I mean, I rarely agreed with Pauline Kael, who I have to say I did not start reading until I was in my 40s, which is kind of bizarre.
Oh, wow.
She was just not part of my childhood in New York and my adolescence and my movie love. It was just The New Yorker was not part of my growing up. And then when I was studying movies, she just was not part of that, you know, just not interesting. But, you know, because I disagree with her doesn't mean I don't find her interesting. That's true of a lot of the critics. Like, I don't care if people agree with me or not about a movie. Yeah. I'm just interested in the ideas. Like, Matt Zoller Seitz, I rarely agree with Matt. But, like, I think he's super interesting, you know?
I'm with you. I'm with that way with Amy. I very rarely agree with her, but I always love hearing how she got to where she got.
Absolutely, you know? It's exciting.
It's funny. I dug out some Pauline Kael recently because she was hugely important to me as a kid. And like I made my parents take the New Yorker just so I could read her.
Oh my God.
you know, and I would like find her books in the library and stuff.
I love it.
And the weird thing about her as time has progressed is that at the time she was really kind of preaching for this unfussy, unacademic, like, can we talk about the actual pleasure of movie going and the actual pleasure in the sort of trashier elements of movie going? But movies themselves have become so trashy now that I feel like we have to go in the opposite direction and sort of like, no, this is an art form, y'all, really.
I need to know how old you were when you demanded that your parents begin subscribing to the New York Times.
I can imagine the 5-year-old like
saying, to know
like,
this.
Oh, 12 or 13.
Oh, okay. That's still pretty damn adorable, I have to say. I think the one, and I don't want to talk too much about Pauline Kael, but one of the arguments I would have is that there's, you know, the insistence about how a movie makes us feel is a little bit problematic because, you know, we have to engage our feelings, but there's more to a movie than just my feelings, you know?
Right.
And I always think one of the things that's really interesting to me about watching movies is how I feel about the movie and then how I feel about how I feel about the movie.
Yes.
you know, and I think that the most articulate way of kind of translating that is watching a movie that has made you cry and you being furious that it has made you cry.
Oh.
And then having to kind of figure out what it was doing and what buttons it was pushing, and did it make you think of like somebody who died that you loved or whom, you know, and just kind of going through that and then thinking like, is that valid or not? But so my feelings are not really the most interesting thing ever about right. what I write. You know, right. my feelings are a place that I start, but it certainly is not the place I end. And
we refer to that as the curse you stepmom moment.
Oh.
The movie Stepmom was like so phony baloney. And then it just plays a card at the end where we both kind of went, and it's like, oh, you got a stupid movie.
But it's the same with everything else, you know. It's just about, like, this movie made me feel happy. It made me feel sad. It made me feel uncomfortable. And then you have to kind of work through unpack your that, feelings yeah. and then think about, and it's not just about, you know, it's not about intellectualizing the experience, but it is about thinking about it. And I think it's okay to think through these issues. There's nothing wrong with thinking our way through the movies without losing touch of the feelings as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of meeting it halfway. So part of it is like, what in me is am I responding to? And also, what's the director doing to like cut onions into the theater, you know, to make me cry about it?
Right. And certainly I can't imagine anyone just wants to read like a solipsistic exercise where I'm just like, it made me feel this and then I felt that and then it made me feel really bad. And you're like, those people don't know me, so why the hell do they care what I was feeling? You know, I have to get beyond that.
Well, Dave had a great disclaimer when he reviewed The Guilt Trip. The Barbara Streisand, Seth Rogen movie.
Seth Rogen, oh, yeah. Streisand.
You know, where he was like, look, this movie worked for me, but my mother just died.
Oh,
I walked out of the, we've talked about this on the show before, but I walked out of the screening with him, and we took the elevator up to the parking lot, and I said, I don't know if that was good or bad. I said, because I miss my mom so much right now, and I'm going to start crying, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. In my review, I have to write a review tomorrow morning. I don't know what I'm supposed to say. In the review, I said, I started the review with, my mother died 4 months ago. I don't know if this is a good movie or not. And then I just went on down mm-hmm. the way. And it was exactly what you were saying. This is how I feel, and I don't know how I feel about how I feel. And that was the review. And I haven't gone back to that movie. It's not a good movie. I know that, but I don't know that I want to see it again. You know, I don't know. I don't want to have that yeah. mommy kind yeah, of yeah, feeling yeah, again, yeah. you know.
But I mean, it's not in any way also to say, I hope I'm not, it's not to say that our feelings aren't important. And I think that that's part of what movies do, is correct. That they do totally. Make you feel these things. And that's very important. And you think, you know, for some reason, Meet Me in St. Louis has been in my head, or really Meet Me in St. Louis, has been in my head a lot. And just about that movie and about how that movie, which is, this is an old Vincent Minnelli film starring Judy Garland. And mm-hmm. it's just truly a beautiful movie. And it's got it's got some really wonderful Christmas scenes too. Yes. But it's a movie about a family that is very much, they live in this glorious old house, big, big house, rambling house, and they're all very happy. And then suddenly the father is going to uproot them, and it just devastates everyone. And you watch that movie, and it really conveys a sense of home and love and family that makes me cry. And just actually thinking about the movie, mm-hmm. I started crying. You know, and I had no childhood that in any way resembles that movie right. at all.
Right.
And yet I have this really incredible sentimental feeling that when I watch that movie, that warmth, that movie is like a fire, you know, and I'm sitting in front of it and I'm yes. just basking mm-hmm. in its glow. And in a way, it kind of doesn't matter that I didn't have that childhood and I didn't right. have that big rambling house and all that. You know, I had a very different childhood. But I have that relationship to it that just is so pure and beautiful, and trying to kind of express that, you know?
I think I've told this story on the show before, but Olivier Assayas's Summer Hours.
Oh my God, I love that movie.
There's a scene early on, and it's not in any way intended to be a scene that's going to elicit specific emotions, but it's just Edith Skobe, as the sort of aging matriarch, is talking to one of her daughters about her son, who's an economist, who's written these books and sends them to her, and they're on her nightstand, but she doesn't read them because she doesn't understand them. I had to leave the theater because I started crying so hard because the thought of my mother having read either of my books, having been alive for me as an adult, for that to have happened, just hit me like a safe. And I've seen the movie again since then, and I know it's coming and I'm fine. It's not like Crooklyn where I have to leave the room. Like, I can watch that movie now. But yeah, like you never know where it's just there's just this thing that expresses a certain humanity, a moment of humanity that's just going to hit you, you know, like a train.
I think it's like the specificity and the universality. It's like finding that like incredible little balance. And it was interesting because Barry Jenkins, who's the director of Moonlight, has talked about people like saying, oh, this is a very universal story. And he's like, well, it's actually very specific, you know? And, and it is. It's very specific to both him and to the playwright whose name I cannot remember, whose work is
Terrell, I forget. I'm sorry.
I blame too.
Okay. And it's about their specific time growing up in Florida as and young men and their mothers both becoming addicts. And it just... So, and yet, you know, I watch that movie and that's not my childhood, you know, and yet I can have this, I felt like a profound way that I was allowed into this movie that somehow, you know, and it's not universal. And yet the specificity is not a barrier in any ways. And I sometimes think with movie studios, you know, with studio executives that they want these universal studios because they want to scoop up as many people as possible.
Right.
And they forget that really great artists can tell you a very specific story, like Olivier Assayas telling a very specific story, or Barry Jenkins telling, again, another very specific story. And it's the greatness of it, of that, that somehow opens a door, and a lot of us who are not black, who did not grow up in a poor, you know, Florida housing project, whose mothers were not crack addicts, can actually enter in and really kind of have that experience with that movie, that intimacy with it.
And that's why a film like Collateral Beauty, which aims for this giant amorphous glob of nothing, nothing that is wrapped in a cloak of, we're gonna make you cry, mm-hmm. now. Is,
oh, we're all connected.
Is empty. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely empty. There's nothing there. You unwrap it. You take off the cloak of you're supposed to be crying now, and you realize, oh, no, it's just gas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's, and none of it makes sense. Mm-mm. And that's because there is nothing specific going on in that film.
No.
It's all about these grand themes of togetherness and human connectivity that are worthless and meaningless.
You know, and no one's going to confuse My Big Fat Greek Wedding with a work of art per se, but that is a movie that almost every immigrant seems to be able to relate to. Like, my siblings always talk about that movie and how the crazy aunts and uncles in that movie remind them of our, like, Spanish family. And so I think there is a thing about when you don't try to be that amorphous and be that sort of like test audience friendly, and you just get super specific and hone it down to a pinpoint, everybody can find themselves in that.
I had I teach at the Art Center in Pasadena, and sometimes, you know, just once a year. And one of my most thrilling experiences recently is that I showed this class John Ford's How Green Was My Valley, a movie that I just love and actually won the best picture Oscar the year that
Citizen Kane.
It beat Citizen Kane, and people always complain about it, but you know what? How Green with My Valley is a masterpiece, and it is a really tremendous movie. And I showed it to my class, and it was a fairly small class. And one of the things is there was about seven kids who were from, they're kids, they're young people in their 20s. I call them kids. And they were from China, you know, mm-hmm. most of them. And they loved the movie. And right. It was so interesting. And one of them said, this reminds me of, and I realized, oh, all of them had, like the characters in the movie, to leave their loving families and travel far away. Right. And it was very much about the dissolution of the family. And one girl started talking about how it reminded her of the sacrifices that her parents had made. And this is a movie, a Hollywood movie, about a Welsh mining town. And right. all of these different kinds of girls, these young men and young women who were from, you know, Indonesia and China and various other places, all could actually feel and experience and understand this movie. And it was just a glorious thing.
Last night we had the LAFCA animation winner was the Japanese film Your Name. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Not yet. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going
to
open wider this year. But the director couldn't come, but he sent a nice sort of video thank you from Japan, and he said that he was that the award was all the more kind of encouraging or delightful or whatever, because so much of the film was so specifically about Japanese culture and recent history and customs. So the fact that it was resonating with a Western audience, I think, you know, he was very excited about.
It must have been thrilling to, you know, that there you did. You did exactly what we're talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had a letter.
Uh-oh.
I know this is
from,
already.
From one of your fans, but he asked, he wanted to know if it was true, and I'm willing to, I'm leaning toward believing that
so
it is.
I am so nervous now.
No, 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 it's nothing bad. Okay. Apparently, Michael.
If it really happened, you're the hero of everybody.
Absolutely. Michael Phillips tells the story that after the Cannes premiere of Antichrist, that you apparently stood up and burst into That's Entertainment.
This is true.
Bravo. Chaos reigns.
Yeah. That was such a funny screening. I was up in the balcony, and it was just so interesting because the one thing, it's a preposterous movie, but one thing is that he had everybody in his grip, you know, Lars von Trier, the director, because the audience was completely rapt, you know, but it was a completely ridiculous movie. I mean, my favorite part is when the fox says Chaos Reigns. I actually have a t-shirt that says Chaos Reigns. Yeah. I love it so much. And just one of the great moments. Yes, because, you know, that's entertainment. And Lars von Trier is, if nothing else, an entertainer. Certainly. That's very funny. Who wrote the letter? Was it
one of our listeners.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, because they people know you come on periodically and they wanted to know.
Oh yeah, you're the most talked about and requested guest.
Oh my gosh!
Among people who listen to the show,
yeah. When people we get more letters who their about favorite you, guests are it's generally always you.
We get more letters about you, and we get more "When is she coming back?" letters.
So much pressure. Yeah. I'm so worried now. Like, yeah. I feel like I've only had two coffees. I need to have one more. I'm so sorry. Well, I'm delighted to be here, and it's really fun to talk to smart people about movies. It's super exciting. I love it. It makes me very happy.
Now, at can screenings, you have to do press us the dress up for these.
Is it... Oh gosh, no. And oh, it's not. Okay. Washing is also apparently not a requirement. So the Cannes is really weird because it's by invitation only, and which means that most of the people who are going there are actually film professionals. And they, unlike other festivals like Sundance in Toronto, there's actually a separate market. So the people who are buying movies go to separate screenings, and then... the press and some others, and I'm not sure who always those people are. Distributors go to the market screenings. Oh, right. Yeah, and then the journalists go to the press screenings, and so they start at 8:30 in the morning, which is cruel beyond belief. And you start right away.
Eight in Venice, just so you know.
Oh, gosh.
That's a dream for me. That's my jam.
Not if you're having dinner at midnight.
But I wouldn't be there. I wouldn't be having dinner at midnight.
But then I'm really, really hungry, and I really, really need food. So you go, and it's interesting because it's a very vocal audience, and the reason I felt comfortable saying That's Entertainment after Antichrist is because it's a very kind, there's a little bit of call and response going on. People boo, sometimes really surprisingly. The thing that I learned at Cannes is to not sit with your friends because you should just sit separate from people you know, because if you know their size, they can be very oppressive. You know, if your friends are like,
oh yeah.
You know, you're just like, I don't want to have.
Sitting next to my husband at certain screenings is. Yeah.
It's like, put a plug in it. So I like sitting separately from a lot of people, sitting not with my friends. And it's kind of interesting because you'll watch a movie and you'll be really surprised. So, like, I watched the Michael Haneke movie Time of the Wolf, which I really liked, and was very surprised at the loud booing that was surrounding me. But I like that people boo, and it's actually and I like that because I feel like, you know, Toronto, everyone's very polite, or they act like the parents of kindergarten students who have won the spelling bee. You know, my child was the number one student, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I feel like you feel that way at like Toronto. No diss on the Canadians, but they're very nice. But
They're
a polite people. And I sometimes want a little, all you have to do is go to France for the not polite people.
the only booing I ever encountered at Venice was at a bigger Splash press screening.
Really?
The Italians don't like Luca Guadagnino, I discovered.
Interesting.
Later,
okay.
So.
And apparently the Spaniards don't like Almodóvar anymore. Either.
Yeah, well, I was just, did I tell the story in the show? Or?
I don't remember where you told it.
I met Kleber Mendonca at the Spirit Awards brunch, the guy who made Aquarius and Neighboring Sounds, and I said, you know, do they like you in Brazil or not? Because, you know, he goes, not so much. And he started rattling off this list of the filmmakers who aren't loved in their own country. And he said, he was like, My Russian friends can't stand Tarkovsky. My Spanish friends say Almodovar is for tourists. My French friends say that Truffaut is bourgeois, which is kind of true.
Which is true. But big deal.
Exactly. Like, that's a bad thing. And then I said, who are the American filmmakers who are more appreciated abroad? And he goes,
Abel Ferrara.
He goes, well, you probably like him, but, you know, James Gray. I was like, ew, no. But yeah, James Gray apparently... They, you know, huge and
He's very, very, like, I mean, he gets invited to Cannes, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think that that's really interesting. I like his work, I have to say.
A lot of people do. I'm in the critical minority. Yeah. The public, I think, could care less either way. That's just kind of an interesting thing of the mm-hmm. people who are not beloved within their own.
Right, and who's a major auteur, you know, abroad, yeah. you know? And then in America, they're like, what?
Like, Orson Welles always had that joke where he would say, like, oh, you know, the French, they tell me I'm one of the three greats, and then because then I'd make the mistake of asking who the other two, and it was, you know, it was Chaplin and Nicholas Ray.
Hey, don't diss Nicholas.
I like
Ray.
Nicholas Ray. This is what Orson said. Okay.
Yeah, maybe you and I should sit apart from now on forever.
Fine. Fine by me.
So I don't have to be hassled by your size,
I'm not
Chuck.
Hassling by you. Yeah.
Do you guys have other sort of... So when I bring my husband to a movie, which doesn't always happen because he often works too late, he's very sentimental. And if there's some sort of like sentimental scene between, you know, two people who love... He will invariably, his hand will just creep over and he'll hold my hand. And it's so sweet. Oh, Dave is pointing it along.
He does it to me all the time.
It's adorable. True. I love it. I mean, I always say, you're holding my hand.
He does that to me all the time.
I love it. I think it's kind of, it's this beautiful experience that you have. So,
yes.
Well, and there are times when a movie is crappy that I will turn to you and be like, we're both seeing this, right? Like,
Yeah.
Have you ever had a movie that actually has so severely divided you that it actually was difficult for maybe even 5 minutes?
Here's what happens. I can't think of a title, but here's how it always plays out. He comes home from something and says, I just saw the worst thing in the world. And you're going to love it. And I come home and say, I just saw something incredible. And you're going. And I'll go with you. And I'm taking you again. I'll take you. And you're going. Both of us know that we're right about how we think about the film.
Of course.
And how we think the other one is going to think about the film. Almost always we're right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stop us from... having an ongoing argument about the film,
mm-hmm.
Or having an ongoing resentment at having been taken, having been taken to it. And I know we've talked about this on the show. We may have even talked about it to you, but the Monica Mana screening was one of my favorite moments.
And I don't hate it. I just, you know.
Monica Mana.
It's an ethnographic documentary.
About the people in Nepal on the
funicular.
I
reviewed it. I love
tram.
That movie.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. I just didn't the title.
I saw it at the press screening.
I adore it, actually.
Saw it at the press screening. I was so overwhelmed and happy and just thrilled by it. I came home and I said, I saw this movie and I'm not going to tell you what happens.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not telling you a thing about what happens in this film, but you're going and I'm taking you because you absolutely must see this. So we go. It's at the music hall. We're basically alone.
I'm sure
there were
you
maybe
were.
Two or three other people, yeah.
And this may be my favorite film going experience with you in my life because the first trip up the mountain
mm-hmm.
is. No one speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second trip up the mountain, no one speaks. And then the third trip is the three kids, the three metal kids,
heads,
the metal
yeah,
boys,
the, yeah,
and they
yeah.
start talking and they talk about sacrificing the kitten and stuff.
Yes.
And the third trip through, he goes, he turns to me and he says, this is the movie. And I said, uh-huh.
Nothing else is going to happen, baby.
Yeah. And then the goats go up.
The goats are awesome.
And he screams out loud in the theater.
Because I knew we were about to get a complete reel of
11
goat
minute
butt.
Of a perfectly composed goat butthole. And I he screamed, and I just was like, I win.
And then I don't dislike that movie. I thought there could have been less of
You didn't hate it. But oh yes, American Ultra.
Oh, that's yeah. That's one of our big fights.
Oh,
yeah.
We had a big fight about American Ultra.
Okay.
I think it's beautiful.
Usually, almost always, it's a movie that Dave likes and I don't. I think the only one I can think of off the top of my head of the movie that I like that he didn't was Carnage.
Oh yes.
But that's the exception.
I wanted to punch every single one of those people in the face. All of them, again and again.
The movie didn't want
I wanted
to
out.
Like
I wanted out after like 15 minutes. I thought, this is not going where I needed to go. I'm done. I'm done with all of you. Yeah. And you too, Roman Polanski. We're on thin ice already.
You and Roman are on the outs.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, American Ultra. That's been the longest lasting feud.
Yeah, that was our most contentious.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
Because I just think it's... I think both of their performances are so lovely. The movie's a crazy mess, but I think their performances are so lovely, and they communicate this devotion to each other that's so tender and wonderful that I stayed right through it.
But you were defending all of it at the time.
Okay, sure.
And that movie's a super hot mess, and the two of them are giving it their best shot. But
I'll tell you something that you already know about me. I fully reserve the right to revise my ideas about things over time.
I'm just saying, don't show off your company.
I'm not. I promise I'm not. I'm just saying.
I didn't mean to like open up old wounds here.
No, don't.
There's no such thing as old wounds.
Okay.
They're always fresh. That's right.
No scab ever gets to form.
I have never approached this job as
definitive statement making.
Me making definitive statements that last forever.
Yeah.
I go back, I rewatch, I think about it some more. If I see something that I did not understand, I feel perfectly justified in saying, I don't get this, I have to go do some homework, I'll come back and look at it again later. When you walked in, you saw this book.
Oh, Straub, yes.
Yeah, and gifted to me by Mr. Severson here because I had just started watching their films.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to Not Reconciled, and I thought, I have no idea what's going on.
But that's okay.
Yeah, and when it was over, I thought, I don't know what I just watched, and I have to go read, and I have to go understand more and learn more. And in talking to a couple other critics who shall remain nameless, they said, well, you should just know. And I thought, why? How? What? I'm still every human being in the world has to keep learning and experiencing stuff so that they can form their thoughts about the things that they encounter.
But going back to Cemetery Splendor, you've said that even if you don't know the full
that's
length
a different
of the
kind of
Thai
not
mysticism. Understand.
Yeah,
whatever.
I don't understand everything about Thai
or recent Thai history.
Buddhist Thai mysticism. Yeah,
you can still sort of like there's things you can glean from the film.
But this is about like German political history,
right?
And I'm unaware. Yeah,
but what's wrong with looking thing up? I mean, I have no problem with that. And I mean, there are also just movies. Let's say that you don't actually have to like you know. Look in the encyclopedia to understand and say, I need to do some research here. But I mean, I always research for documentaries just because I'm trying to do my due diligence and trying to find out stuff. And it's like, oh, is the documentary actually representing something truthful? Like, but that's separate. But I find like not understanding a movie completely delightful. Like I know, it doesn't bother me. And I'm always
it doesn't
so,
bother me. Yeah.
I'm so
at
interested.
All.
People get angry though. I remember like when Mulholland Drive came out, people were like angry about that movie. You know, they didn't understand the end. And I just, like I had to see it twice to fully understand it, but I didn't. It didn't make me feel stupid, you know. Like there's no, the movie wasn't. I didn't feel it was trying to play a trick on me.
Right.
You know, it was just let me engage. I mean, you go to look at a beautiful painting. Maybe you don't understand that painting in full. Do you, the first time that you went to look at, you know, you looked at a Mark Rothko. Did you completely Right. Now, you know, you go to a Rothko and you just try to experience it, and then maybe you'll read about it, and then you'll start reading about color, and you know, right. just. But that's okay. Why not?
Right.
We want movies just to reveal themselves completely to us. That sounds kind of uninteresting.
As I get older, I am less reticent to cop to not knowing things or not getting things. Like, especially if I'm reviewing a film out of a festival and I have to give you like kind of a spot analysis. Yeah. Like when I did Nocturnal Animals of Venice, I'm like, I got to see this again to really understand what that ending was about. But I think I know maybe. And in any event, it's interesting and it's saying something. I just couldn't tell you right now what it is.
I think that kind of pronouncement style of I know, and this is what I think, and this is definitive, is the game of younger people in general. Mm. I think the older you get, the more, if you are a thoughtful person, the more you're willing to say, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't
I have
know.
To go figure this out and learn more about this.
Yeah. And no shame.
But yeah, and so the mystery of a film like Cemetery of Splendor or Mulholland Drive is a different kind of not knowing than the very specific
historical
right. referencing right. that's going on in right. these Strobe-Ouillet films, where I, like I said, watching Not Reconciled, I thought, I don't know what just happened. I have to go read. Mm-hmm. And I told Matt that. He said, I have a book. I said, thank you. I'll borrow the book. He's like, I'll bring it over.
But both are about being open and confident enough to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think that there's, you know, whether it's younger people or the pressure of social media where you're supposed to have like this instant reaction, you know.
Right.
And like after festivals, I like just to kind of sneak off by myself just so I can mm-hmm. remain in that bubble and think it through, you know.
And which brings us to another story involving you.
Oh, my God.
After watching we may have actually said this the last time you were here, but after watching The Purge 2.
No.
I was taking my notes, and I'm writing Escape from New York, you know, like, and on my notes. And then I walk out of the theater, and you and Amy are standing off to the side, and you raised your arms, and you were like, John Carpenter rules. And I was like, you shut up right now, because I have to go write about this. I don't want to hear it from you, Manolo Dargis.
I'm so sorry. And
so that I do the same thing. Uh-huh. I don't get in the bubble of people who will congregate outside the screening.
Oh yeah, festivals.
I can't do it. I will not be fighting with anybody on film Twitter about uh-huh. anything uh-huh. ever.
Best to avoid film Twitter, in my
and that's
best.
Well, yeah. But no, I get it.
I'm so sorry about the John Carpenter. It was
no,
just,
it was funny.
It was just
it
so,
was funny.
It was just so interesting to like, oh, I'm watching a John Carpenter movie. That's great. I hope he gets some money out of this. You know?
I sat down and wrote the review, and I thought, I'm just going to talk about John Carpenter anyway. She doesn't run my life.
She doesn't own John Carpenter. Of course not.
I had that idea separately.
Of course. I know. But but you want to kind of watch the movie in complete isolation. You want to watch it with an audience and yet at the same time not hear what anyone else is saying, because you want to have that experience with the movie, that director.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the great things about going to festivals, don't you think? Like, because
no
one's seen it yet, and you actually get to enjoy Nocturnal Animals by yourself and think about it and not have had it pre-digested for you already.
Yeah.
You can just like, oh, I can have this immediate experience. Isn't that delightful?
I do find myself, weirdly enough, I don't think I've ever read less film criticism than I do lately, only because I make it a point not to read anything before I see a movie and before I write about it. And then once I've written about it, I'm done.
I know.
Like, if it's something I really love, then I want to go off after writing about it or talking about it on here. I want to go read as much as I can
mm-hmm.
from other people.
Right.
And see what they're saying.
Right.
Because there's got to be something I missed. There is absolutely something I missed.
Did somebody bring
that
something?
Someone else is going to bring up.
Yeah.
And so, like, I've been reading every review of Tony Erdmann that I can find.
Oh.
Because I love it so very much that I just want to know everything that everyone's
mm-hmm,
thinking
mm-hmm,
about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's one we've been fighting about, too.
Oh, really?
Well,
oh.
With an asterisk, as listeners know, I've mentioned this before, I saw it by myself on a screener, and
ooh.
I thought it was deadly.
Ooh.
But I've read so many reviews that talk about seeing it with an audience that I'm going to go see it with an audience
okay.
before I sort of have
okay.
my final
okay.
verdict. And so I'm going to see Tony Erdmann. He's going to see La La Land because he only
okay.
saw that on a screener.
Okay.
But yeah, my first Tony Erdman go round was just.
Oh, I'm so sorry, because I wish, as my friend, I wish that you had seen the movie that we had seen.
Well,
you
know sure, what I mean? Me
like,
too.
It's like this Y'all very are so delightful.
Excited about it.
Absolutely.
I wish I had, you know.
Oh, that's too bad.
And maybe yeah. I still will. We'll see. Okay. Now, so you mentioned documentaries. We were gonna circle back to that. This was an amazing year for that kind of thing. And did you watch all of O.J. Made in America?
I absolutely did, and I think it's terrific.
So great.
And I'm completely uninterested in the debate about whether or not it's a movie. It's a movie. They called it a movie when they called Ezra Edelman up, and it's a movie. It's like, you want to make a film about O.J., and he's like, yeah. So it's a movie. I think it's tremendous, and I just think it's such a pleasure to kind of go deep on the issue. And I also was so surprised because I had watched
American Crime Story.
I'd watched that, but I also had watched the original O.J. I mean, watched the whole trial.
Yeah.
And I actually walked into and was thrown off. I went through voir dire in a Judge Ito trial. I was it was very very
before
strange.
Before or after?
After. So it was very very odd. When I walked in, I burst out laughing because it was Judge Ito. I felt really terrible because you're not supposed to laugh.
And they kicked you right out.
No, they didn't. No. They
you saw the clocks and everything.
No, they kicked me out because it was a horrible case. I don't want to get too sidetracked on it. And Judge Ito kept asking me, "Well, if I ask you to put aside your prejudice, will you?" I said, "Well, you can ask me, but I'm not going to." And so then I got kicked off. So.
Where were you when the Bronco chase happened?
I was actually in a grocery store, I think, and for some it was a health food store, and for some reason they had a television, and I was looking at it, and I just thought, what is this, you know? And it was the first year that within the first year of moving to LA, so it just felt like I had the like real LA introduction. So yeah, I thought it was tremendous filmmaking, and I thought it was really smart to do it all, you know, starting with opening it through sports,
yes.
You know, was just really, really brilliant and kind of explaining what OJ meant to people, you know, as a sports hero.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's become something of a buzzword now, but if you're going to talk about intersectionality, like that movie, it's sort of the way it layers together sports and celebrity and wealth and fame and race and crime and all these things that you know, and I've said it before, like if O.J. didn't exist, a novelist would have to create him, because there's so many ways to, so many stories that get told in telling that one story.
And I think with some, you know, there's a lot of documentaries that are kind of like hit and run documentaries. They, you know, they have one thing and they do it, and it's clearly that they shot very quickly, and it just feels very superficial, and you just feel like, well, that told me next to nothing. It was like a paragraph worth of material. So it's really a pleasure to have someone go in depth, you know, the way he does. But I thought it was great. I really love Ava DuVernay's 13th. I thought it was great.
Oh my, yes.
You know, I think it was a very, more interesting and a deeper movie than, let's say, some people seem to think it was. You know, I was very knocked out by that. A really strong movie. So I was super excited.
I think it's premiering now streaming, so I got to watch this thing. But I still haven't seen Camera Person. I've heard great things. Did you like it?
Have not seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
Somebody who I love told me I would hate it, and I just, it was like one of those desperate things where I had like too many movies to watch, and I feel terrible, you know. It's like you see hundreds and hundreds of movies, and it's like, I didn't see everything. I'm sorry. So I think for all of us, there's probably like one movie where you're like, I should have seen it, but I didn't. I'm sorry.
Wiener?
I didn't like it. First of all, it's ugly as sin. It's just a really, like, I mean, on technical level, I just, like, I think I could shoot a better movie with my iPhone. You know, I just thought it was, like, I thought it was visually very ugly. And I just think at this point, seriously, I mean, you have people who are making beautiful documentaries like Ava DuVernay. Like, really, you can't make a better looking movie. You can't actually shoot something that is not repellent. And I'm like, I just didn't like it. I just felt like it didn't do anything. I just felt he was kind of pathetic and he was pathetic. I didn't like it. I felt like it didn't tell me anything new or interest. I didn't, like, you know, I read enough about it. I didn't really, this wasn't adding anything.
Okay.
I just, you know, all I felt was I had watched The Good Wife and I was watching another
another season.
Another sad episode.
Did you see De Palma?
No, I haven't seen that. Oh. But I know Noah Baumbach, so I just, like, I'll get to it eventually. Okay. So I'll see it. And I, you know, De Palma, I'm so up and down in De Palma.
Well,
so.
Me too, but he turns out to be one of those people that I would much rather hear talk about his movies than see his movies, or some of them anyway. Like, I could hear him talk about Snake Eyes for the duration of Snake Eyes rather than see Snake
Oh,
Eyes.
Oh, I sure don't want to see Snake Eyes again. No, thank you.
And I've heard, and people have kind of ragged on it because it is, I mean, it's all him. They don't interview anybody else. It's all first person. Yeah, and I'm fine with that. But obviously, you know, his point of view is his point of view. And so it's not, I don't think, meant to be this sort of, you know, the last word on everything. But people are picking at it because it's so skewed. I'm like, well, that's the nature of the beast.
I'm just curious, like, where did people get this rule book about documentaries, which I seem to have missed about what a documentary is? I mean, I believe in documentary ethics, you know, which is a different question, but this idea about, like, what a documentary is supposed to be.
They can't
be
subjective.
I'm very confused. Like, I somehow miss that. Like, if somehow in my education as a movie critic, I miss that whole, like, book. Was it handed out to people? I mean, it's just like, why not? Sometimes documentaries can just be talking heads. That's all. That's enough.
Right.
You know, it doesn't...
Oh, well, that aspect nobody minds because I mean, it is literally one singular shot of him in a chair talking, but then interspersed with this incredible array of clips, not only from his films, mm-hmm. but like of, you know, Vertigo or whatever, like whatever he's talking about, you know.
No, but I've had people who've complained about movies, you know. I had someone who said to me about the Ava DuVernay movie, like, it's just talking heads. And I'm like, so unlike Earl Morris's movie? Like, what are we actually talking about? Anyway, I just think it's really interesting that certain, like, to me, that's the least, I think people have this certain idea of what a documentary is supposed to be.
Sure.
And it's actually, I like all the different kind of variations in documentary. Yeah. So.
And that's not even a valid description of 13th, because there's those amazing montages.
Absolutely not at all. No, believe me, I was thinking, this is not what we're talking about, is it? We're talking about something else here.
I finally saw...
Matt has a question.
Yes. No-Ho movie being part of that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
no,
so, yes. So that was my number one movie. Oh, Matt. you know, that's a really interesting thing because No-Ho movie is by Chantal Ackerman, and Ackerman apparently committed suicide sometime before this movie was made. This movie is about her mother. And that was a movie that was really interesting to see a few times. And again, like all great art, I think it's okay to go back to movies. And sometimes a movie, Ackerman does not make movies that necessarily reveal themselves to you on the first viewing. Sometimes, and also it's not necessarily, it's something that you may need to work through. And I don't mind that. And I don't mind duration as well. She's very famous for taking these for very long takes. Mm. And so the very first shot in No-Ho movie, which is mainly about her mother and her relationship to her mother. Her mother was a victim of was a Holocaust survivor, is of a tree, of a very scraggly tree hanging off what looks like the side of a kind of desert mountain. And it's shuddering violently in the wind. And the shot holds for a minute, and then it goes into the second minute. And I think I was at a film festival, and I was like, oh my God, what the bleep is this? Like, and I've seen most of Chantal Ackerman's work, and I know it, but for whatever reason, I was in this, there's this thing about, I think Americans, and I sometimes find this when I go abroad into a film festival like Cannes, like, you have to reset your bodily rhythms, the rhythms that you are used to in watching predominantly American cinema, but also Western cinema or Western cinema, commercial cinema, which is faster, 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 what Bordwell calls intensified continuity. And you have to reset your rhythms, your physical rhythms for the movie, because you're now maybe going to watch a movie where the first shot is 5 minutes of a tree, and you need to just calm the F down, you know? And I had to do that. And it's like, I come in, I know Chantal Ackerman's work. You know, I've seen Jean Dumas many times. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I should know this. But I'm sitting there going, what? Ah, this tree shot. And it just took, and then the movie, and it basically what she does is a lot of very kind of unadorned, and I would say not terribly beautiful, but actually very nicely framed images of inside her mother's apartment. Her mother's quite old and quite frail, and throughout the course of the movie you see her mother's health declining. And then every so often there'd be shots of the desert, you know, and it took me a while to figure out the desert thing, and Jewish people and the wandering people in the desert and homeland, No-Ho movie. Oh, I get it. That was, but you know, it wasn't like I just sat there and from the first shot I was like, I completely understand this movie. No, the pleasure of that movie was figuring it out and working it through and understanding it. But I had to kind of, I had to calm down for that first, you know, and it's like watching certain Romanian movies abroad. You're like, okay, this shot is going to be a six minute, you know, and we're going through a hallway for a very long time.
Yes.
Calm down.
One of the first,
sink into it.
One of the first movies I remember doing that to myself was The Scent of Green Papaya. Like, oh, okay, we're just going to chop for a while. I'm going to take a deep breath, and we're going to go with that.
And he had seen, I'm sure, Jean Dillman making meatloaf, you know, as she does in the movie, very famously.
Well,
No Home Movie, by the way, is on Filmstruck, so I have not seen it yet.
Right.
It's on my list of things.
Our Chantal Ackerman experience was at CineFamily. Was it earlier this year?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was golden
80s.
Oh, yeah.
Retrospective.
And there were no subtitles.
Oh, my Lord. Okay.
But we stayed.
So we stayed through the whole thing anyway.
That's awesome.
Because we were so stoked about seeing it, and it's so rarely screened, that we thought, it's a musical.
we'll go for it.
We'll figure it out. He understood, every 12th word of French. Yeah. You know.
High school French.
Oui.
Bonjour. You reminded me, the 6 minute shot of a tree. Peter Hutton died this year, and
2016,
this past year. Yeah. Sorry, in 2016, and I've talked about it when he died, but for anyone who didn't get that episode, he was a filmmaker of landscapes, and you really have to reset your rhythms to watch one of his films, because it'll be about the movement of a bird or a truck or something, or a crane over a building site that's slowly moving, and that's 70 minutes, and you had better reconfigure your eyes for something like that.
But it's great. It's like, because I feel like what you have to do is that you have to, like, and I do feel this when I go to camp, like, just, I have to kind of shake my body out and just, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's, you know, I know that you were talking about Faust, you know, the Sokora film, and, you know, long takes, quite a few long takes, you know, and you just have to okay, this is a horse. And the horse is going down that road. That's a beautiful horse. That's a beautiful shot. But then it also makes you think, like, there's more to a movie than the story necessarily. Mm. You know, it's the graphics. It's the beauty of it. You lose yourself in it. I also think, like, you lose yourself in it, and then maybe you go away for a while from the movie, and that's okay. And maybe you start thinking about something else, but then if it's a good film, you come back to it.
You know. So we always say about Cemetery of Splendor that if you take a nap, it almost feels interactive.
Yeah, exactly. But that's okay. But it's this idea of what a movie is supposed to do. I think the kind of, you know, the kind of Hollywood imperative in entertainment is that, you know, that you're entertained.
We all walk around the same thing.
Right, and you entertain in the same way. And actually, there's a different way of experiencing a movie. I mean, speaking, you know, something like Bellatar, who did the Turin Horse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, his famous 7.5 hour movie, Saint and Tango.
Yes.
You know, that took that first shot of Saint and Tango, if I'm remembering right, it's
the
been
cows.
A while, is the cows walking through a muddy field. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, because that was in 6 minutes. That's like 15 or 20 minutes. And I was like, and this is a 7.5 hour movie. And then you're just sitting there and there's like a moment.
A 7.5 hour movie with like 40 shots or something. Yeah.
And you're sitting there and there's all sorts of things going through your head. Oh my God, I'm here for 7.5 hours. This shot has gone on for 7 minutes. Oh, wow. You know, and that was a very transformative and really important experience though for me watching that movie, because the sheer beauty of that film is so overwhelming that I did feel like I physically like settled into it and just kind of merged with the movie. And like I felt like I was kind of in the, like there's a space between me and the movie kind of closed over the hours as hours passed in a really fascinating way.
Right.
I don't know about you. I felt like I was tripping by the end of that movie. In a good way, you know? Like I reeled out. It was dark and I was like, whoa. I was in Bellatar land, man. That was awesome.
When I was a little kid, that was my favorite thing to do. Go to the kid matinee.
Come out in the dark?
And you go in and it's daytime. When you come out, it's dark. It's nighttime. And you get to go home and have dinner right then. Okay. That was always my favorite. It felt so disorienting that it almost felt like part of the film as when I was a child. It was this complete experience of leaving one part of the world, going into someone else's world, and coming back out into an entirely different world because the sun had gone down. And when you're seven, that's very important.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I get
it. I like that. I like that feeling when you walk out of a movie and you've had a very profound relationship to you've experienced something profound. And you walk out and it's kind of like when you've been away from your house, you know, you've been away from home for 2 weeks, let's say, and you come back and everything seems a little off. It seems like three right. degrees off. Like it seems, it's strange again. Your house is strange and you have to familiarize it. You know, and I feel that with some movies, you walk out and the world just feels a little bit off and different. But I love right. that. That's a beautiful thing.
Agree.
Okay.
We agree.
That's all I had to say.
Shall we wrap up? Is there anything we sure. haven't touched on that we
We have ranged far and wide.
Other than you're missed at the dinners, at the last dinner.
I know, it's true. We, you know.
So how was Shirley MacLaine? Because that was what I was real. That was the reason I would have gone.
She was a treat. I got to present to her, actually.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah,
cool.
So I introduced Jack Black, who was just effusive and gushing. He told this great story about how he and Richard Linklater really wanted her for Bernie, and so they had this meeting with her in Santa Monica, and she was like, look, I don't see this character as a bitch, I see her as a survivor, as a, like a strong woman in a man's world, blah blah blah, and they were like, yes, yes, fine. She goes, alright, let me see the sketches. You know, the character, the costume, wig, like, well, you know, you've got some preliminary drawings, right? And they're like, we don't have that. She's like, Billy Wilder wouldn't be caught dead with at least one sketch.
Oh my God.
And so they just knew from that point on they had to be like on it. On wow. the on what Jack Black called their A+ game for her.
Wow, that is awesome. What's your favorite Shirley MacLaine movie? Do you have one?
It's hard to pick.
The Apartment.
Oh, okay.
No.
I mean, you know, I love Terms of Endearment. I love The Apartment. I have a weird soft spot for a movie that I know is not very good called What a Way to Go.
Oh, I've never seen it.
It's she mentioned it last night when she was reading bad reviews of her own movies. And she goes, director J. Lee Thompson, and she put her hand up and kind of did the glug glug.
Oh.
Because this is the guy who directed The Guns of Navarone.
Oh, yeah.
And this is like a sprightly comedy written by Comden and Green. So like it doesn't fit. But there's an over the topness to it that I kind of enjoy. Mm. So, you know. What's yours?
Some Came Running.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a glorious movie.
Also Vincent Minnelli.
Yep. I'm a big Vincent Minnelli fan, I have to say.
She breaks my heart in The Apartment.
Absolutely.
And that is,
oh, yeah.
And
breaks
that
my heart in Some Came Running. Yeah, no,
yeah.
She's great. There was something really beautiful about her. I wish she had acted more, actually. You know?
Yeah.
I've still never seen Sweet Charity.
Oh, we should have a Sweet Charity viewing party.
Ooh, let's. Okay.
That would be fun.
It has kind of a mixed reputation, but it's like, it's Bob Fosse.
I
want to see it.
Exactly.
I'm into that idea.
Okay, cool.
So, Manola, you, as you mentioned, you are online now. Where can people find you?
On Twitter?
Mm-hmm.
It's at Manola Dargis.
Okay.
And then that's basically it. I have a Facebook account, but it's kind of limited to
gotcha.
A few
all
thousand
right.
people.
So, fair enough. At Manola Dargis on Twitter, and of course at the New York Times. And you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
All of them.
At LinoleumCast.
Yep.
And you can join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
There's a real sexy picture of you on Instagram on the LinoleumCast account pumping gas last night. Before the,
I saw that,
before
yeah.
The,
it was
in a
awesome.
Tie before the dinner. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very formal evening of gas pumping.
on stage and off.
There you go. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Manola, you're so awesome. Thank you for coming
Thank
on
Thank you
show.
For having me.
Thank you all for listening. We will catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.